www.thebeatsofmetal.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. The Silicon Valley venture capitalist John Doerr was present at the creation of the new economy. He saw in the internet a universe of bankable ideas that would change the world and make a ton of money. His line, quoted many times, is that the internet has meant the greatest legal creation of wealth in human history. John Doerr has recently been apologizing for that remark. He says he never expected so many people to focus on the money. His question and ours is, are we creating something that will last? We're talking this hour about the business revolution that is sucking millennial brains out of the Procter & Gambles of the world and the famous consulting firms, sucking them into dot-com startups. Connection listeners, who's running the store when every bright young thing in America is headed to a business world without cash revenues? Do you want to be a millionaire, Connection listeners, and how many tries are you willing to take at it? 1-800-423-8255. Well, 1-800-423-TALK makes the internet business model connection. Our guest in the studio is the business writer Glenn Rifkin, author most recently of Radical Marketing. We're also joined by Michael Porter of the Harvard Business School. Glenn Rifkin, what is this new business model, and what is that the stampede into it doing to the old business model?
Well, Chris, the new business model, the new economy, as people call it, is all based around the internet, this whole dot-comming of America that's happening, of the world, in fact. And what it means is that we're in a major transition, and it's having a tremendous impact on the old line, what we call bricks and mortar companies, on every level, from personnel, how do you hire, how do you retain great people, how do you pay these people? These whole issues, all the issues around compensation are just, you know, out the window.
You pay them with stock options, right?
Well,
all the stock
options
they can eat.
Options are the word. You know, the concept of stock options in the Silicon Valley has changed everything. And, you know, we're all out there watching and reading and hearing about these 25-year-olds who are now multimillionaires, billionaires. And it makes us all wonder, you know, what the heck is going on? And if you're working, if you're getting out of college, if you're starting your career and you're saying, which way am I going to go? It's pretty enticing to say, let me hook up with a dot-com startup, get some options, get part of the equity of this company. And if it goes public, if it does well, which many, many of these have done in the last couple of years, I can be set for life financially before I'm 30 years old. It's a real tough argument to go against if you're an old line company when you're trying to recruit the best and the brightest. So that's what's really at stake here. And also what's at stake is the model of doing business itself, because the internet has changed the stakes to the game, and these old line companies are scrambling to find a formula that works, to find a formula that gets them into the e-commerce space, that gets them to be hip and cool for their customers, et cetera, while trying to retain these high-level people from the CEO level on down, and it's really created a scramble.
What does it mean that the best and the brightest are not going to manufacturing anymore? I mean, I suppose the model in my head is Robert McNamara out of the Harvard Business School into remaking the Ford Motor Company and the Defense Department. What does it mean that he'd be doing, I don't know, stakehome.com if he were a kid today?
Well, there's no question. You know, look at the Harvard Business School, where the average graduate of that program, the two-year program, has been getting $150,000 starting salary out of that school. You would think that would be enough to keep those folks happy and into the pipeline of corporate America. Instead, what you're finding is a major percentage of that class, I believe it's something like 40%, are heading into the dot-com world. They say, why should I go into this corporate pipeline where I have to work my way up the food chain like we used to do? When I can get in, I can be part of something exciting and new and get going. Not only that, but the financial rewards are very evident. So it's just changed the rules.
Michael Porter is on the line. Michael Porter, I mean, you have two hats here. One is the ultimate business school professor, also father of the consulting firm The Monitor Group, and a consultant yourself. How do you see the big trend here in business models?
Well, I think that Glenn has captured a lot of the key elements of it. Let's step back a little bit. What's happening with the internet is that the way that many of the processes or activities that firms conduct the way they can do things is being changed by this internet technology. You can do Salesforce differently. You can do marketing differently. You can do distribution channels differently. You can do supplier sourcing differently. And that's creating, you know, millions and thousands of opportunities for this new technology to be applied in ways that create value for companies. And, you know, kind of the first order effect of the new technology is that it's creating a lot of new business development opportunities. And that's the dot-com thing. We can come back to that. But there's something much broader going on here, and every company in America is going to be on the internet. Every company in America is going to be involved in e-commerce. It's just that the dot-com companies have taken the first steps. They were there first because, you know, the new enterprise always can move faster. But the more traditional companies are coming on strong. They're responding. The bricks and mortar companies are responding. You know, what's going to happen over the long run is that the internet's going to just be part of the business landscape, just like the automobile is today, or the truck, or the telephone. Everybody's going to be doing it, but there's this moment where an enormous entrepreneurial opportunity is being created during the transition between, you know, zero and that future moment. And that's what's drawing all of the excitement, the entrepreneurial energy. But it's very fragile, I think, Chris. We must realize how fragile this is. You know, many of these young people are getting shares of stock which they're not able to sell because they have lockups. We have another week like last week on the market, and a lot of this stock is not going to be worth very much. So this is very fragile. And the early people that are there at round one can do enormously well. But that doesn't mean that this is going to be a good and even a profitable business arena for many of the young people that are going into it now. You know, I like to say, Chris, that whenever Harvard Business School students are thronging into a particular field, it's already past the peak. we had that in real estate several decades ago. We had that in consulting. We had that in investment banking. So I think that it's some of the greatest fortunes probably have already been created. And I think now it's going to be much more competitive. There's many companies competing in every market segment now. There's all kinds of bricks and mortar companies coming back with their own internet offerings, trying to counterattack. We've been in a phase so far where nobody's making any money because everybody's investing for the future, which they hope will come, and they hope they'll get a market position, and they hope it'll be profitable. But we are in a phase where some of the kind of fundamental rules of economics and competition are being temporarily suspended, but they're not going to be suspended for much longer. And so it's kind of a precarious time now, although I must say, as I sit here at Soldiers Field at the Harvard Business School, there is still an overwhelming number of new ideas bubbling around and new projects and new companies. So it's literally a fever.
I want to get a sense. It strikes me, even as you speak about it, Michael Porter, that this is a more different world than you're acknowledging. For one thing, I mean, these startups, they're small groups as opposed to big companies. They're very insecure. It really is a crapshoot in an awful lot of them, as it is not when you go to work for Salomon Brothers or a big consulting firm, or much less Procter & Gamble. Just in terms of the conception of people's lives coming out of college or business school, it seems to be an enormously different atmosphere than it was 5 years, 10 years, not to mention 30, 40 years ago.
Definitely a different atmosphere, and it's one, frankly, that in at least in general terms, I wholeheartedly support. I think that too many young people were opting for the kind of safe, prestigious, large enterprises, and we had very few students, you know, doing entrepreneurial things, starting businesses. Yet what we find consistently at Harvard is that 20 years out or 25 years out, when people come back to their reunion, a large fraction of our graduates has been entrepreneurial, has their own business, has their own company. So what this has done is it started that process earlier. I think that's great. Having said that, this is not It's fun. It's exciting. You know, it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, 24 by 7. And you literally work 24 by 7. And you literally, the pace is enormously great. You get very low salaries in many of these companies. Your betting comes totally on stock options, which are only going to be worth something if the company goes public, and then only if the stock price holds up for at least 6 months after they go public. So there's a very different risk-reward profile here. And I think a lot of young people are saying, gee, you know, this may crash. I may not, you know, they have overly optimistic hopes for the future, but I think they realize that, well, you know, we're in a tight labor market, so even if this fails, I'll be able to go somewhere else, or I'll be able to go back to the consulting firm. So I think part of it is that the general economy is so good right now that people are not feeling insecure, and they feel like there'll be a soft landing if they happen to crash.
Michael, this is Glenn. I was just wondering, you mentioned before, just in passing, you thought this was going to be over soon, or this transition is going to be over soon. I wondered if you could be more specific about that, because
Yeah, what's next?
Because it doesn't feel like it's over, or even close to it from where I sit.
Well, over is I'm not talking about the internet being over. What I'm talking about is the ability of companies to get financing based on virtually any idea. I'm talking about the ability of companies to go public with no clear business model that is profitable. I'm talking about the ability of stock prices to stay high and grow while companies are not producing even minimally interesting financial results in terms of profitability. That's what I think is going to change. Let me be clear. The internet is a major technological breakthrough. In some sense, it's not. It's you can see it as the latest generation of information technology. It's really the next big wave that started when the computer was invented, 30, 40 years ago. And then we went to client-server computing, and now the internet is the next wave. It's much bigger than the previous generations. It's an enabling technology. It will transform the way literally every business is done to some extent, and in the process, it's creating many opportunities. So I'm not at all hesitant about the future of the internet. I'm very, very clear that I understand what that is. What I think is more fragile is the way to get rich by starting a company that isn't profitable, that goes IPO, whose stock price goes up seemingly with no logic. I think we are, I don't know whether it's going to end next week or a year from now, but you can hear the buzz underneath. You can hear the.
It's a fascinating notion, Michael Porter, that by the time the Harvard Business School kids catch on, it's too late. What is the next wave if the dot-com startup phase is coming to an end?
Well, I think what we're going to see is a lot of interesting transformations in the quote traditional economy. We're already starting to see that. We're starting to see major companies aggressively embrace the internet in their strategy.
Yeah, but are they going to be able to offer the real high that the startups do of starting your own thing, being in a degree independent, being your own gambler with your own talent?
They will never be able to match that. However, the existing companies are becoming much more aggressive in their compensation packages and their being much more flexible about forming spin-off ventures.
Yep. I saw Chase.com recently. Chase Manhattan started Chase.com, and not only that, but started as a subsidiary in which the employees actually get equity. They are in a different building. They don't wear shirts and ties like other bankers. They can just do their thing. And that, I think, is what Michael's talking about.
There's going to be a lot more of those. The traditional consulting firms now, the McKinsey's, the Boston Consulting Groups, are all pushing into the internet space in one way or another. They're incubating new companies of their own in which they own some of the shares and the people doing them own some of the shares. So what we're seeing is that there was a vacuum. There was this massive technological opportunity that created a lot of business opportunities. There was a vacuum where the dot-com entrepreneurs kind of perceived this first. They rushed in. There was extraordinary economic rewards for the, you know, the kind of first wave. Now we're going to see, now we're going to be in a transition for some years where, again, my bottom line would be that it's not, it's going to be much harder for the dot-com startup, to actually, you know, be successful, make money, and go public and cash in the same way as the first waivers did.
Yeah, the bigger question to me, though, is this going to be, say, a return to normalcy, like the people on the site saying, well, this is just a phase, and we'll all go back to the good old days? From where I sit, it looks like there's a fundamental shift in the business model and the way that business is done, the theories that you had that were so, you know, seminal in the 1980s. Are we going to go back to just traditional work, or is this really beyond just a dot-com startup or getting people getting rich, but this a real shift in the fundamental way that business does business?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I think that I would say that what's fundamentally shifted, you know, probably irrevocably, is the way, the specific ways in which business conducts itself. So, for example, you know, sales forces are never going to run the way they used to. They're now going to be much more cost effective because they're going to embody internet technology in the way a salesman does his thing and the way the sales force relates to the website and so forth. So the specifics of how businesses work is going to be changed to varying degrees irrevocably. What I believe will never change is the fundamental core principles of competition. And that is that, you know, you can't make money unless you're in an industry where there's an attractive industry structure. Unless there's barriers to entry, unless the customer doesn't have too much power, you'll never make money. I think those rules will assert themselves very, very strongly. A company can never be profitable unless it has a competitive advantage. You can't have a competitive advantage unless you can command a premium for what you do or have a lower cost of delivering your services to competitors. And I think what's happened over the last 5 years or so is that those things were temporarily suspended. If you could call yourself an internet company, you could be viewed as an attractive investment even if you didn't have a competitive advantage, even if you were in a crummy business where everybody could pile in after you. What's, I think, going to assert itself is really the core fundamentals of competition, the fundamentals of economic value, I think, are invariant to technology, to time. Those are going to reassert themselves. But what will change is the means or the way in which businesses conduct themselves.
Okay.
So that would be my way of kind of seeing the future. And again, I think we're already seeing that. We're already seeing that, you know, the companies that are starting today that are just another portal that don't have anything distinctive, you know, that have no barriers to replication, to entry, they're getting trashed, and nobody's investing in those anymore. People are looking for things that are going to be profitable, and I think that's just going to get that's going to be a stronger and stronger trend.
Michael Porter, you're fascinating as always. We're talking about what may be, shall we say, a winding down, but who knows, golden moment in American industry at the dawn of the internet age, a moment in which it seems all the talent that once upon a time went into industry, manufacturing or consulting or investment banking, is rushing to start its own millennial dot-coms. Michael Porter at the Harvard Business School, thank you for being with us. The phone is 1-800-423-8255. Glenn Rifkin, the business writer, is with us in the studio. We're talking about the giant sucking sound to the new startups. Shalamit is on a cell phone.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome. Shalamit, did I get the name right?
You did. I wish I was there in person. I'd give you a dollar.
Thank you.
I love your show, and this is an especially interesting topic. I just wanted to call and share my own experience. I'm 26, just undergraduate degree. And
billionaire yet? Or?
No. Hoping. I'm in week two, actually. I just joined a business-to-business e-commerce startup. I don't have the pipe dream that I'll become a millionaire. If it happens, it's not a bad idea. But I definitely agree with all of the comments that the guests have been making. I do believe it's a fundamental paradigm shift in the way that our economy works and the kind of business that we have. I do think the pendulum has swung a little bit too far to one side, so undoubtedly it'll come back. But I agree with what one of your other speakers had said, that I don't think we're going to go back to old business. I think it's just rough and tumble right now because we're learning how to do things a different way, and it definitely is pretty bad for the brick-and-mortar companies because, you know, they're basically out of luck right now, but I think they're going to find a way to work in the new economy, too.
But is the moment, this explosive entrepreneurial moment, coming to an end, Shulamit?
Oh, no, not at all. I think we're always reinventing ourselves. You know, if you look back 20 years, what, you know, now we look at it as old hat, but, you know, when it was happening, it was revolutionary. I think that's how it always is going to be.
Yeah, I don't think it's coming to an end at all either. I think there's a ton of venture capital money out there that's just waiting to be spent. And when Michael says, you know, any dot-com that comes along with any old idea is not going to get funded, I think he's correct. And I think people are starting to look for the value proposition more so than even 18 months ago. But still, there's a tremendous billions and billions of dollars going to these startups. And if you have a great idea and you can make the value proposition, it isn't anymore, at the moment anyway, about profits. It isn't about revenues, as you can see. I mean, you look at the numbers, it's startling. Business Week last week had a story about the market value of traditional companies versus the new economy companies. And it's incredible. The Coca-Cola in the space of from last May to now has lost $52 billion. In market value. Bank of America, $51 billion in market value. While Cisco, which is considered the prototype of the new economy company, its net worth in terms of market value has gone up nearly $300 billion. Cisco last week, for just a brief second, was the most valuable company in the world, bigger than General Electric, bigger than Microsoft. Now the stock plunge at the end of the week changed that. But the point is, the money, follow the money, show me the money. That's what it's all about. And it's still flowing that way. And I'm telling you that the best and the brightest are seeing that, and they want to go that way. And I think the question Michael didn't answer was, what happens to the traditional businesses when the best people are not there?
Okay. We're talking about the flow of money and the sucking sound of big talent. This is The Connection. 1-800-423-8255 makes the new business model connection. Thornton May is a corporate futurist for Cambridge Technology. Thornton May, what's happening out there?
Well, hi. It's great to be here. I've really enjoyed this show. I like Glenn. You're doing a great job. Michael did a great job. And Chris, this is just excellent. Now, as a corporate futurist, you know, I actually study past futurists, if you will, and they always get it wrong, if you will, like Edward Bellamy, Looking Backward, Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, Ray Bradbury, Fahrenheit 451, George Orwell, 1984. They always get it wrong, and there's a pattern to this wrongness.
Okay.
What futurists do wrong is that they underestimate the forces of technology change, i.e. they underestimate how good technology is going to be, and they underestimate how much people can change or assimilate this change. And that goes directly to Glenn's point, is that what has happened is you now have in this new economy the fact that great ideas get funded. And so what we're finding is that the behavioral change is that the smarts are going where their ideas will be listened to and attended to. We teach a program with UC Berkeley out in Silicon Valley called the Silicon Valley Program for people, and we teach that with a professor by the name of Jonathan Sullivan, and he basically says, like, the reason people leave companies is because they have a crummy boss or because, like, they're not working on meaningful work. So the challenge, I think, to, like, some of these, if you will, brick-and-mortar or traditional organizations is to make, one, get rid of bad bosses, and two, make sure they're working on something meaningful.
I just want to get this straight. You say we normally, or the futurists normally, overestimate the force of technology and underestimate the people factor? Or did I get it mixed up?
They underestimate how significant technology is going to change, because if you look at these people, you know, they extrapolate from the existing technology base versus saying, recognizing that we will have step changes. Basically, we will have a change how you live your life technology insertion every 5 years now in today's environment. All right, so they miss that.
Okay.
But they always say, like, people will become, rational. Now, I had the good fortune of working at Carnegie Mellon University, where we all apprenticed to Herb Simon. And Herb Simon, of course, being the Nobel Prize winner, and he got his Nobel Prize for telling us that people aren't that clever. Well, actually, he said that people aren't rational. And so we're seeing some of that, but what we're trying to get to is that the smart young people, and by the way, it's not just young people that are smart. If you actually peel back the covers, some of the great startup companies, some of the great dot-coms are doing something we call generational blending. That is, they've got some of the, and forgive me for saying, some of the old farts, mm-hmm. and they've got some of the, you know, if you will, like, you know, daycare folks, you know, working together to actually, like, do the heavy lifting for this new economy.
Mike, Michael Porter's line just a moment ago was that the old rules of competitive advantage and barriers to entry and kind of traditional kind of organizing principles of a capitalist economy are coming back, that the sort of suspension of disbelief in anything with an internet or a dot-com on it is about to come to an end.
Well, with all due respect to Dr. Porter, he's absolutely wrong. I mean, if you look, Michael got his PhD in economics at Harvard. He walked over to the business school and started analyzing the structure of industry. Right? The empirical base for his model was 1945 to 1975, which is a period unique in economic history for its lack of competition. And all the companies that Michael studied were essentially oligopolists. And the problem with Michael's model was that it can't be operationalized. I mean, Porter's model says that the best way to compete is not to compete. Whereas what we're getting here now is, like, basically every organization, every individual is a bond trader. They are alive. They are in touch with their customers.
Thornton May, don't go away. You're just getting warm, and we want to get you back after the break. We're talking about the new economy and the new business model. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the new business model connection with the business writer Glenn Rifkin. In our studio, Thornton May on the phone, a corporate futurist at the publicly traded consulting firm Cambridge Technology Partners. Could I just ask you, Thornton May, I mean, you say this explosive ferment moment is going to be with us a long while, maybe forever. Is it a business building ethic among these kids, or is it kind of running the tables at Vegas and retiring at 29 kind of hope?
Chris, you have been doing your homework, because that is the spot-on question.
Ooh, just guessed.
What's going on now is like we're actually watching the tribes break up, because what is happening is we really are building a new economy. You know, an economy that comes closer to, if you will, like the design specs of the human being. All right, because if you get that, remember, you know, cognitive science and anthropology. What happens is the consultants for years.
Let's get cognitive science in here. Go ahead.
Change is difficult. Change is unnatural. Change is bad, right? Whereas what change is actually, that our forefathers or the people who climbed out of the primordial ooze, change is a natural thing. I mean, look at how we are built. I mean, our skeletal structure has us so like we can basically look 180 degrees in front of us. Looking backwards is an unnatural act. And yet most of business for the last like 40 years has been looking backwards. So basically, we're now moving into the...
Somebody might be catching up with you, as Satchel Paige said.
So you got the people who are actually moving forward, and then you've got, if you will, the yuppification of the whole new economy thing. And what is going on is you now got people who figure out that there's money here, and these people, and venture capitalists are getting better at this, and so are public investors, is that you're looking at people who are either building a company or people who want to cash out.
It's changing,
Glenn Rifkin.
It's basically changing the work ethic of America. That's what I think is really the crux of this matter. If you look at the model, it used to be you got out of school, you got your first entry-level job, you worked your way up the chain. If you were really talented, in 30 years, you might be in line to be senior VP or CEO, and you'd make a lot of money then. it's no longer the case. Newsweek did a survey of young people in college a few months ago, and 61% think they're going to retire between the age of 40 and 50. 77% believe they're going to be millionaires. They're all not that far off if you go by the model that's happening now. My question is, Thornton, what do you think? I mean, what's this all going to do to the business model, to the work ethic, to Horatio Alger, if all of that's out the window?
Well, it's not out the window, but what is happening is, like, organizations, basically, you know, these bureaucratic organizations basically said, like, you know, only the top can really be good. And what really drove my awareness of this new economy was I'm sitting at a cocktail party at the Sky Bar in L.A., right? I'm sitting there, you know, there's Michael Ovitz and there's, you know, all the guy who founded Creative Arts Agency. And I said, you know, this new economy, you know, is it real? They said, it is so real. I said, well, what do you mean? What's driving this? And they said, fear and greed. I said, no, 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 it can't be fear and greed. Fear and greed have been the pillars of global civilization forever. They said, no, no, this fear and greed is different. The fear is that your dream will pass you by. And the greed is you can have it all. No? And I'm just going, wow, how cool is that?
So it's Gordon Gekko plus one.
Exactly. I mean, it's out there. But now organizations have to reconceptualize themselves such that it's not just Mahogany Row that makes money.
Right.
You know, and this is what, you know, and we at Cambridge, we could, every person a millionaire, right? Because everybody adds value. And that's what you got to get to. You got to open up the value. It used to be just the top of the house got the money.
Hmm. Well, you know, I like that.
Now we said, like, everybody wins.
Not just Mahogany Row makes money.
Mahogany Row, which is, you know, that cush carpeting. And
got it.
Yeah, well, we're they're all in situational retirement.
Don't go away. Thornton May is on the line. Glenn Rifkin's in the studio. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about what the dot-com startup economy is doing to everything, including the work ethic, including the old businesses. 1-800-423-TALK. Cindy is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, Cindy. Welcome. Good.
Thanks. I'd like to counter the notion that joining dot-coms is about greed. I am a MIT Sloan School of Graduate dropout. I left in my third semester to start a company or to work with a group of people who are starting a company. And there are a number of reasons why my experience was so incredibly special and I would do it all over again.
Mm-hmm.
The first was that it was an incredible team and the energy that I had getting out of bed to go to work or to go to my computer, which was where my office was greater than I've ever had. I created my own hours. So I'd get up at 11 in the morning. I could work till 7. I'd go out with my friends until 10, come back to my computer, work from 11 till 4 in the morning.
The sun never sets. The sun never rises.
The sun never sets. But it was great. And then finally, I very much created my own role within the company. When you're working with a team of 10 or 15 people, what you're good at is very quickly recognized, and you're shunted into a position where you can do something valuable based on your own skills, as opposed to working your way up through a company lockstep where you have to fit into somebody else's notion of what you're supposed to be doing at any given moment.
Could I ask you, Cindy, is it a team when you're spending most of your days and nights sitting alone at your computer?
It's very much a team. We are either together in person, you know, we'd meet up in the afternoon for a meeting, or we'd, meet for coffee to talk about strategy, or we were on email and ICQ and other sort of interactive, using other interactive devices.
And are you a billionaire yet?
I'm not a billionaire, no. In fact, the company failed. And I'm ready to do it all over again.
See, I don't think that this is about greed either on its own. I think greed is always a factor in what motivates people to want to succeed. But I agree with Cindy that a lot of this is about finding the most exciting place to be. And I think that's even more of a factor for somebody right out of business school or right out of undergraduate who really doesn't feel like they have to cement themselves into their future yet. So why not go to the most exciting place? I mean, you look at a company like Akamai here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that's just been siphoning off this great talent from the MIT community. All of them are millionaires. There's like, 400 employees at this point. Every one of them is on paper a millionaire. But, you know, they could probably all become millionaires at 10 different companies. The question is, where's the most exciting? What's going to be the leading edge? Where am I going to get to be what I want to be?
No, but Cindy, you said quickly there that the business failed, and you're still completely sold on the model.
Very much. very much.
And ready for the next one. I mean, they say that's the most valuable thing. You gotta take two strikes before you hit the home run, and you've now had the downside.
Yep. I wouldn't go back to work for a traditional company unless it were in its dot-com division, and its dot-com division were run very differently from the rest of the organization.
That's fascinating. Would you go back to school and get your degree?
I would, and I will.
Thornton May, would you invest in that girl?
I most certainly would.
Thanks, Martin.
That's fascinating. I mean, does this story sound familiar?
It very much so, and it's because one of the things that is happening is that what's really the real change is that the internet and it has basically sent an unambiguous signal to corporate America is that you've got to design your organization around your people, because the people are ultimately your source of sustainable advantage. And so, like what Cindy said about no job descriptions and working on stuff that matters, that is the most important thing.
And I think that, you know, to add to that, you look at this model and you say, can these organizations do that? You know, you look at what we just assumed were great traditional companies, Procter & Gamble, General Motors, General Electric, Gillette, and you say, are they capable of making this transition? Or if not, what's going to happen?
Right. Well, one of the things that is changing is as we move into this new economy and as Dr. Porter said, I mean, it's really, a lot of this driving this is the internet thing or the technology in space. What we're doing now is we're watching a major reinvestment in the technology infrastructure of these organizations. You're moving from a 3-6% of annual turnover spent in information technology. That's going to move to 20-40% in the next couple of years.
Hmm.
And that's going to be huge. So you've got all that money being spent, and what it's being spent on is the question used to be. And Glenn, I know you used to be a technology writer, and you were focused on this for a while. The money used to, the question was, what computer should I buy? The new question is, what computer should I be? It's all about information processing, and so there's real power in touching customers. Or as Cindy said, it doesn't have to necessarily be a commercial customer. It could be some type of customer or some type of eleemosynary institution. You're touching something that matters. So we've become externally focused versus internally focused.
1-800-423-8255. The startup revolution, it's still going on, Thornton May says. 1-800-423-8255. James is calling from a car phone.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, James.
I want to make two quick comments. First of all, I've been in the industry for about 20 years now. And for me, I wanted to echo a little bit as an old-timer what Cindy is saying as someone just coming into it. I've had stock options for most of the time I've been in this. I owned 0.5% of the Xerox spinoff for about 3 wonderful months before it augured in. And, even today where stock options actually may mean something, it's not what it's about for me. I mean, I'm now working at a company where for the first time in my life, I define my roles. I'm very well compensated. I'm actually working for one of the few profitable internet companies out there. It's just such a great work environment. This Friday, we're all getting on a plane and flying down to Puerto Rico for a weekend cruise because we did our numbers last year. I mean, you know.
The question is, will you stay there for the long haul? I think that's part of the issue. If you're 25, even if you're a 20-year veteran, you know, is this going to be a 2-3-year stint for you? And then you're going to say, well, I've been there, done that, and I'm going to move on.
Well, we do consult work, so I'm always doing something different. I mean, as long as I'm getting challenged to doing fresh, new stuff, and they compensate me well, and they treat me well, and I get flexibility like work at home, sure. I mean, you know, I'm very loyal to companies. I stayed at companies for 4, 5, 6 years. Until usually, I rarely am the one who terminates the relationship.
Hmm. It's funny, he says 4, 5, 6 years. You know, it used to be you stayed 30, 35 years. No more.
James, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. What is the effect, Connectionist News, on this enormous rush of money and now talent into the dot-com startups? And who's minding the store, not to mention running General Motors? 1-800-423-8255. John DeFigueredo is on the line. He's a professor of strategic management at MIT's Sloan School. John DeFigueredo, how do you see it? I mean, where are we heading now? You've probably heard Thornton May and Michael Porter and Cindy and others. What's happening here?
Well, I think that what we're going to see, I think the transition is going to last a bit longer than Michael has suggested. But the internet is coming in waves. You know, we saw the first wave be this business to consumer, the dot-coms as we traditionally call them. The second wave we're seeing right now is business to business e-commerce. How do we bring buyers and suppliers and the wholesale markets together? There's certainly two more waves that people around MIT believe are going to occur. The next wave that we see on the horizon is what we call internet infrastructure. Things like networking, switching, optical networking is very hot right now. And finally, we're going to see wireless web applications and those evolving. And so I think what we're going to see is that the internet offers a lot of opportunities, and it'll be kind of rolling opportunities. And what kind of captures the interest of the markets at the time is what is hot. But, you know, business to consumer right now is very hard to fund. I advise a number of students on these startups and talk to a number of VCs, and it's clear that they're no longer interested in business to consumer. That has played out. We've seen the competitive effects Mike was talked about in that market, and they haven't, and these have proven not to be, in general, extremely profitable market segments to be in. So we're searching for the new market segment.
How many of your students go to work for the big banks? Big consulting companies anymore, much less General Motors.
The percentage is decreasing. I don't have the exact numbers. I know about 3 years ago, about 60% of MIT Sloan students, MBA students, went to work in consulting or investment banking. But it's certainly that number is decreasing and decreasing fast. Students come back to me with their tales of successes and failures after having been out for a couple of years at these startups. And many of them who have failed have said, you know, I learned a lot from failure. I'm not punished for failure, which is a big difference in the economy today than it was 20 years ago. If you had failed, you would have been kind of branded for life as a failure. Now it's you've learned from the experience. And what many of them do who fail, they decide to move on to slightly less risky companies, so maybe companies rather than companies with 10 people, companies with 70 or 80 people who have a higher probability of succeeding. And so you're seeing that occur amongst students, and it's certainly they're learning, and the incentives are matched to the risk in many cases. And that's something that I think we're not really talking a lot about here, which is There's a lot of failure. 9 out of 10 of these companies are going to fail. And students recognize that, and they also accept that there's a big upside if they do succeed.
Well, there's also you see this at the other end of the spectrum. We've been talking only about students. I think the higher level executive run out to the new economy is fascinating to see as well, which is what I brought up before. How does this impact these companies? When you're seeing almost weekly now some major business story about a defection at a high level, either CEO or senior executive level, to the dot-com world, and what impact that's going to have. And you see, you know, if the entry-level students are going there, and then you start to see the CEOs going there, it's going to have a huge impact on the traditional businesses.
This is Thornton. Glenn, you're exactly right, because the big challenge, strategic challenge facing senior management groups in incumbent, if you will, players in the economy, is repositioning themselves out of this dinosaur-like market. Marketing. We had an interesting cocktail party several years ago with we had Mr. Gates there, and we had the vice chairman of one of the large New York money center banks. And this was right after that whole Intuit thing when they were going to buy Intuit. And Mr. Gates was trying to tell the bankers that, well, don't worry, we don't want to be a bank. And the vice chairman of this large money center bank looked at Mr. Gates and says, either do we. Right? And so one of the things that you are seeing is you are the vice chairman at Chase actually goes on to say, we are not a bank. We are an information technology company masquerading as a bank. And so what you're doing is they're trying to get out of these labels, if you will. There are some very, very dynamic things going on under the covers of some of these big companies.
The question I think that's quite interesting is, when will this bubble burst in terms of being able to get these incredible valuations for these startup companies or even existing companies like Cisco, where the profits and revenue figure really doesn't matter. Price earnings ratios doesn't matter anymore. That the valuations are built on some other criteria. Are we going to go back to the days when profits really matter?
Interesting question, but stand by, Glenn Rifkin and Thornton May. John DeFigurato, I'm going to let you go. We're going to take a very short break here. Thank you for joining us, John DeFigurato from MIT Sloan School. This is The Connection. 1-800 423-8255 is our phone. Adam is on the line.
Good morning.
Morning, Adam.
How are you, Chris?
Good.
Good. I'm calling. I'm the founder of a very early stage B2C.com. We started working on this in about 95.
Business to consumer, okay.
And what we actually did was probably something that turns out in the long run to have been very foolish. We built our business, established a real good customer base, showed why we were delivering value, actually were profitable, believe it or not. And when we went to raise money, what we were hearing was that, you know, you've got a great concept. This is clearly a good business, could be a good long-term business, but you're just not competitive with deals we can get in and get out very quickly. And the questions are all about financial engineering when you talk to venture capitalists these days. They're about what you can sell as sustainable rather than what you can build as sustainable and have for long term. And lately we've seen, you know, one of the playouts that was sort of predictable from our perspective was that we've seen some people come in who have more sort of fantasy compelling concepts that seem to be able to build much more quickly. But if you know the business very well, you know that these people aren't going to, they don't have a profitable economic model. In fact, they're not even trying to. And so everybody's talked about.
But isn't it the venture capitalist's job to know the difference?
Well, the venture capitalist's job is to make fast returns for their investors. And what we have now is the public markets have essentially taken over the role of traditional venture capitalists. Instead of a business starting, seasoning for a few years, finding its legs, and then going on to be a long-term sustainable company, you know, people want to get in and out in 18 months, which is perfectly rational behavior. I mean, investors are almost super rational this way.
What I was going to say is that
what you end up with is, A, a lot of good ideas simply can't get funded because they don't offer that immediate, you know, 18 to 24-month turnaround. Our business is going to need 3 years. And what you do see happening is businesses that sort of make sense in comparison to other models, but aren't necessarily working or going to work, have an easier time selling sort of the snake oil of we're going to get in and out very quickly and make a lot of money. And
is this a problem, Thornton May?
Well, actually, I think that it is a problem in the very visible venture capital community. What we're doing is we've actually seen the venture capital community evolve, because you're exactly right. The caller is exactly right, is that there is an element of, if you will, on steroids venality associated with many of the public VCs, where they're basically turning these things every 18 months. But then the opportunity of venture capital has basically trickled into these large organizations. So all the large organizations now, all the incumbent players, all the Fortune 500, all the FTSE 100 have now created their own internal capital groups. And they are now looking at, they would actually value the customer relationships and some of the new technologies that may not have the sex appeal or the street appeal, as you will, because, you know, in venture capital, ROI, it's not a PE ratio, it's a PR ratio, you know, public relations ratio. But the real businesses are taking real good looks at funding these new ventures via these internal capital groups. So I think that's going to be a real hidden driver of this new economy as we move forward.
Stand by. I want to get one more caller in. John is on the line.
Hey, Mr. Lydon. This is a great show, as always.
Oh, thank you, John.
I just wanted to sort of get at what Cindy was talking about with what was going on here, more than just the money and the sort of entrepreneurial excitement, which is certainly there for sure. But I think in many ways we're a generation in search of a story, and that the sort of internet explosion is the tableau in which we're able to write that story. And I think...
Give us the storyline of this generation's story, John.
I think you get the story if you... I go to Harvard Law School, and if you go to one of the classes being taught on Internet and Society, taught by Jonathan Zittrain or Charlie Nesson or somebody like that, you get the sense of energy and excitement that you really can work on a huge variety of issues at the cutting edge and have a meaningful role in those issues. If you care about social justice, you can help bridge the digital divide. If you care about civil liberties, you can work on speech. If you care about rights, you can work on privacy. If you care about governance, you can work on internet taxation. There are so many ways in which people who are our age can get engaged at a very high level and sort of almost take our place in society where the boomers used to have the sway. Now we can sort of come in and work on a ton of different things we care about at the level we want to work.
So add a buzzword to Thornton May's fear and greed. Fear of that the dream could pass you by. Greed because you might have it all, but something extra, John. What is it?
I put in energy.
Energy. As Cindy Weaver said, teamwork, community. Thornton May, what's your word?
I would say that as an incumbent organization, they have to design where you can do the best work of your life.
I know what they get out there. It's connection.
Yes.
Glenn Rifkin, thank you. Thornton May, thank you. John, Cindy, all the callers. Thanks enormously. Michael Porter, John DeFigueredo. We had help today also from Glenn Alexander, John Hoder, John Marston, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. Our website is theconnectiononeword.org, run by our website producer, a man of the new economy, Jim Norris. The Connection is produced by modern people, all of them, Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hathi, John Holt, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our new age senior producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. Coming up on Here and Now at Noon, in addition to the news, everything legal to deal with a beagle who's proving a stubborn beast, and lifting the fog that's surrounding the frog, in northern New England at least.